This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, good morning. I'm Sharad Kutin and with me Tan Chung Han. And it's a Friday and it's the 21st of July, which means not only is it the end of the week, it's almost coming up to the end of the month and payday.
Yeah. I guess that's how we ascertain.
Sorry, we're kind of losing you a little, Han. Are you back with us?
I believe so. Yes.
Oh,
yes.
I can hear myself. Now, crikey, you're very loud.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I guess that's how we measure our progress in time and in life, I guess. Paychecks.
Well, yeah. Paychecks are one, but, you know, there are also rites of passage. You know, we have, we don't have bar mitzvahs here, but people have their circumcision ceremonies, what they call. And then there's, you know, because it's about reaching adulthood. Or you could have, I don't know, baptisms.
You could have birthdays, you know, instead of circumcision parties.
Birthdays are too regular. I mean, when they're rites of passage, they're usually a transition from a one state of being to another state of being. So from being a child to being an adult, some people from one gender to another. I mean, all kinds of rites of passage.
And hopefully your paychecks are more regular than that, than your bar mitzvahs.
Yes, because that, bar mitzvah, as with the circumcision ceremony, it comes just once in a lifetime, I think. So, all that being what it is, let's have a quick look at what's happened around the world, and including Malaysia over the last 12 hours or so. Well, two Malaysians have been arrested, and they were among kidnappers charged with a kidnapping in Manila. So that was a story for some weeks ago, but now a huge number of people have been arrested, mostly from China, but two Malaysians are among them. Also, do you remember the story about the kidnapping in Manila? I don't, actually.
Yeah, neither do I, sorry.
So many things happen around the world. How to keep your mind on everything. Mm. Also, in Malaysia, the Malaysian authorities prevented and detained and then deported a Bangladeshi activist, Adilur Rahman Khan. He was here for a conference on the death penalty. Mm. This is part of a long history of deporting human rights activists who are visiting. I believe there was a young Hong Kong activist also in the past who came from the Hong Kong protests. He was also deported some time ago. Also in the news, you can see that in the newspapers today, is that ongoing discussion about whether Indian Muslims in Malaysia can become Bumiputra and to what extent and what kind of privileges they can expect when they become Bumiputra. And of course, also the other side of the story is, does the country benefit from this ongoing division of people between Bumiputra and non-Bumiputra? India's got a new president, Ramnath Kovind. Linkin Park's Chester Bennington commits suicide. And Anne Clyde, a UK Labour MP, issued a early day motion on 1MDB in the British Parliament. So all that is in the mix for you. And some of those issues we'll be taking up in due course the rest of the day. So, but first, let's hear from the Rolling Stones, Shine a Light, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was the Rolling Stones, and Shine a Light. Shine a Light on Tan Chung Han. Shine a Light on me, Sharad Kutin.
Oh, thanks.
It's a Friday. It is very exciting. I was going for a Jamaican accent there, but I decided
I wouldn't
try it. Yeah, that doesn't work for some people. I do want to come back to a little news item that we picked up on just now, which was the issue of UK Labour MP raising something called an early day motion on 1MDB. And just to clarify, these early day motions rarely see the light of day, meaning they don't get discussed in Parliament. One way in which MPs in the British parliamentary system can get something of this sort spoken is to get as much support as they can from MPs. I believe only two, three MPs have actually signed on to this EDM.
Yeah, at least according to the a screenshot of the document that we that was sent to us, apparently there are three signatures on these on this EDM, early day motion.
So the question, of course, is then what is the purpose of this motion? Was it if there are issues related to the seizure of properties and the you know, the U.S. Justice Department investigations and seizures, or in fact other investigations, other jurisdictions, including the Swiss and the Singaporeans, then does it need to go through Parliament, and you know, does it require discussion at Parliament? Or is this, in fact, you know, kind of well-timed gesture, you know, through some sort of lobbying? I'm not quite entirely sure why Anne Clyde would be interested in this, and reports don't tell you enough about the background to this early day motion. Anyway, that's just a bit of clarification there. Now, on to a topic perhaps of interest to all of us is how do we interpret the world and especially the people around us? Apparently, one way is to look at the language they use, and because it betrays something of their inner character, something that we might think is quite stable, not just what they're interested in at that point in time. So they, in this article that was published on the BBC website, the examples that are given, say an extrovert might say something like, "This article is excellent," whereas an introvert would say, "This article is very informative."
So, yeah, essentially, extroverts are said to use terms that are more loose in nature, whereas introverts would use something that's more specific. So introverts, you know, hence would say, "This article is very informative," versus an extrovert's declaration of saying, "This article is excellent." So apparently this stems from a some research done a few years ago, led by, I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, Camille Boekeboom at VU University in Amsterdam, that asked a group of 40 volunteers to look at photos of different social situations and describe out loud what was going on. So trying to ascertain those differences between the kind of language that an extrovert would use and also an introvert would use.
But you know, for me, the difficulty is that you're already designed, I mean, it's a kind of self-fulfilling thing, right, in many ways, because you're saying that you're already kind of designating somebody an extrovert or an introvert. I wonder if people go through the day expressing different moods, and that, you know, they might be much more expansive, in which case their language would be, you know, such, or much more circumspect. And maybe that would be a better way of, you know, of figuring things out. I mean,
yeah, and also I'm wondering, you know, if a lot of this has to do with just, because it's obviously limited by your vocabulary, right? So if that extrovert, and I'm using air quotes here, that extrovert is surrounded by people who often use these very, you know, overt terms, overt yet loose terms, like very exciting, for example, as opposed to an introvert, again using air quotes here, who's been hanging around a lot of people who are just very descriptive and very precise.
Okay, how do you respond to somebody who uses the expression "wow" a lot? Like everything is a wow.
It's all right.
It's all right, because I think because you're kind of familiar with the American context, and I find that there's some cultural context where something like "wow" gets used in a way that that I think is kind of unnecessary. Right? For me, "wow" must be something extraordinary. Well, but you know, it's like, oh, you know, my brother got married over the weekend. Wow! And I was like, no, actually, it doesn't deserve a "wow" because people get married. It's not a "wow" thing. If you know, if like his. My brother and his bride, you know, parachuted into the church where they got married. Now, that would deserve a wow.
So it's all about the cultural context as well.
Don't you think?
Yeah, obviously, you know, because even here in Malaysia, we are so flippant about, say, death. You go die, lah, or die, or I die lah, like that. You know, I think die, right? So, you know, when we use these words kind of flippantly, it depends on the cultural context. So, you know, likewise.
You mean you wouldn't have that in an American context?
No, I mean, like, you know, no one would say, you know, go die, lah. I will die, lah, like that. Yeah, well, it's different. So, wow. And it doesn't necessarily mean wow, and die doesn't necessarily mean die. Just like
so, what does wow mean then? to you?
Well, it's just like a lie. It's like, oh, like really? You know, it just really depends on the context. I don't know. I'm not a barometer for.
So, are you very sensitive? Just very quickly, do you think you're a kind of person who's very sensitive to the language that other people use? Or are you fairly generous and think, well, it doesn't really matter?
I'm okay.
You try to go for the inner.
Yeah, I try to go for the intent. I try to go for the intended meaning. I think that's more important than the actual, you know, syllable that actually comes out of the mouth.
Syllable. Die. Oh, goodness. Yeah. Big words there. A polysyllabic word there. Okay. And after these messages, The Cure with Friday, I'm in Love, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. I'm sure it could with me, Tan Chung Han. That was The Cure, Friday, I'm in Love. Because I think what they're referring to is Friday itself. I'm love for Friday is because Friday is the gateway to the weekend, isn't it?
Oh, it certainly is, and especially if you know those of us who have endured, and I use the word endured, a long, arduous week, then certainly Friday is a cure to all your worries, at least for the near term.
It's time to catch up, rejuvenate, you know, change gears in terms of what you're focused on. If you've been focused on work all week, then it's time for family. And if you've been focused on family, it's time for hobbies. And if it's been hobbies all week, then you're very, very lucky. Sorry, all week, then you're very, very lucky. Now, I don't know if you've noticed recently, Han, a lot of articles in the newspapers about plastics and how much plastics we've generated over the decades. And there are all these extraordinary ways of describing how much plastic there is in the world. And the latest one that I read was that if we covered New York in plastic, it would pile up 2 miles high.
Wow.
But I thought, well, that's an interesting way of dealing with plastic, because maybe we could take all the plastic in the world and keep it in one place. So it'd be a rather hideous pile, but at least it wouldn't be polluting the oceans, where a lot of plastic ends up. And because it chokes animals, sea mammals and fish and all kinds of things. And it's really been a disaster for the planet.
And didn't we talk recently about that floating plastic island?
Raft. It's a raft.
Oh, it's a raft. Yeah.
No, basically, it's all this plastic debris that's kind of like moving in our oceans. And there's one of them has been identified and was, quite a large area of plastic that's just floating about.
And in fact, recently, when I went scuba diving off the Gili Islands, off Lombok in Indonesia, you know, it was just heartbreaking, because we went to this one particular spot, okay, which was called like Turtle Nest, Turtle something, right? But and we did see many turtles there, but at the same time we saw like diapers and plastic bags, you know, around that same area as well. So it was really, really heartbreaking to know that you've got the residues of just human waste right there next to where all these turtles are living and breeding as well. So you know, it's something obviously has to be done, you know, obviously a lot more education and perhaps legislation as well, like we have seen even here in Selangor, right, where you have the state government implementing that ban of sorts on plastic.
Were you
bags?
One of those people who just embraced that, or did you bristle the idea that you were being forced to give up on plastic?
No, well, I stacked up on my paper bags, because so often you go to these conferences and they give you these exhibition bags and this, yeah, you know, the sling bags. So I had a whole bunch of them anyway, so it's been great. I actually get to use them for something, you know. But I wonder how prohibitive that 20 cent per plastic bag tax, so to speak, is, really, because it's just 20 cents, right?
Well, what I find is that supermarkets that I go to sometimes give me cardboard boxes to carry away my stuff,
nice.
And that's been very good. Mm. But the question is, okay, say you're kind of convinced that this is a bad thing, though I think there are a lot of good plastic things in the world, like plastic Tupperware, recently I bought a Tudong Saji, you know, one of those covers made in southern Thailand. It was just an itinerant seller, you know, in tradesman in Lucky Gardens in Bangsa, and it was so beautiful. It was just made of very colorful plastic, and I bought it because it looked like a piece of art. And anyway, so I think there can be beautiful plastic in the world. But let's just talk about, how do we give up on plastic And there's, in fact, a group, I believe, in Malaysia called Sampah Menyampah, and it's a community group that wants to promote a cleaner, healthier environment. Mm. And one of its founders, Marina, gave a talk on how to live without plastics. Mm. Now, do you think you could?
Yeah, I think so. And I guess a big part of the solution will depend on how readily accessible those alternatives are. Because, again, for example, even with the ban on plastic bags being implemented here in Selangor now, right? Yet, I do find myself also at times, oh, I forgot my bag. Hey, I need a plastic bag. How much? 20 cents? Sure, why not? Don't even think twice. Just pay 20 cents.
I've done it many times.
Exactly, right? And I'm sure many people do it as well. So again, how prohibitive it is. And secondly, how easily accessible these environmentally friendly alternatives are available, like plastic bags. And you know, how prevalent are they?
Yeah, right? But the question is, how do you live without plastic bags? I mean, what would you have to do exactly?
So I've got a couple of those conference shop, I use them as shopping bags now, right, in my car. But because I have the luxury of living right above my grocery store, you know, so I just walk downstairs and grab the stuff. And usually I can do it because I just pick up like a couple of things at a time, just walk right back up to my apartment. You know, but in the instance when I do have to buy more than 6 items and my pockets cannot fill them and I forget my bag upstairs, then I get the plastic bag.
Okay, yeah. So the thing is, the thing about most plastics, at least for consumer use, is related to a culture of disposability, right? Mm. Basically, disposable things, disposable forks and spoons. And there was a point in which you would go to anywhere and they would not give you something disposable. And then it became like disposable was good because it was also hygienic. You didn't have to wash it. And because when you wash or depend on somebody else to wash something, they might not wash it well. And so there's all this kind of complexities around plastic. But we're running out of time. We're coming to the first bulletin of the day. We'll be back with more plastic fantastic news for you. This is first Monsters and Men with King and Lionheart, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Shoaib Kutin, with me, Tan Chung Han. And that was me bumping into the board. Now, I'm not going to say ouch in pain because I do feel the pain, though. But interestingly enough, people who feel perhaps a little more pain than I do are people working illegally in foreign countries. And of course, you know, in Malaysia, we talk incessantly about people overstaying, undocumented workers and such. But in a recent report by the Canberra Times, based on the latest statistics on illegal immigrants in Australia, it's revealed that Malaysians top the list of illegal overstayers. Almost 10,000 Malaysians are overstaying their work or tourist visas in that country. 10,000 out of 64,000 in a whole, right? And mm-hmm. So the other nationals that are involved include Chinese nationals, they come in second, also US citizens, British citizens, Indonesians, and Indians, those from the Indian subcontinent.
Now, I recall from my time spent in Sydney, for the record, I did not overstay. I worked there legally, thank you very much, for the likes of KPMG and whatnot. So, yeah, legit jobs. But I did come across many Malaysians who were actually there and had overstayed. In fact, a couple I met had been there for over 7 years, totally overstayed. And no, when meeting these individuals, I find that they hold on to this notion of, and very religiously, this idea that the grass is greener over there.
Even though they are, in fact, there. So often that attitude is of people who haven't left, who are looking at something they think is going to be better from what they have.
Right.
But these are people who've gone there. In fact, the overstayers and statistics include the fact that many overstayers of the total amount of 64,000, some of them, because I believe will be Malaysians, that they have been there for over 15 years.
Yeah.
So you know what the grass is.
Yeah, but even then, they are still holding on. You know,
so maybe the grass is green over there for some people.
Well, but then when you hear them, you know, describe their day-to-day lives and what they're actually doing, they're out there working in the orchards, picking fruits, you know, in the middle of nowhere where it requires like a half hour, once a week drive out of your orchard to get to the nearest Woolworths to buy your groceries, you know, that kind of places. Or they're working in the slaughterhouses and they're getting paid less than minimum wage. Yet, they're willing to stick
less than minimum wage in Australia. Is that more than what they would get in Malaysia?
Well, yes.
I mean, if you think of them as rational people who make a rational calculation, right? They're not just ideologically driven, or it's not this, that their rose-tinted glasses are so thick that even when they get there and conditions are so bad, they don't see them. I mean, they're kind of like wading in, you know, in, I don't know, cow blood or kangaroo blood or whatever it is, and they still think it's better. I mean, if you assume that they're rational human beings, then that maybe when they do the calculation, it really does add up to a better life for them.
Well, I guess the same rationale would apply for, you know, illegal immigrants here in Malaysia as well, who are willing to just slog it out, be it in the construction industry or as maids.
Or live under the threat of being harassed by people in authority or being having money extorted from them.
Right. And so then the idea is to, after a few years, save up enough money and then ship it all back home and build a house or something. So likewise, you're right. Even though they'll say they're getting paid anywhere from $10 to $12 per hour, which is far below the minimum wage. I can't remember now, it's 15 or 18. I got to Google that real quick. But still, they are able, I mean, if you convert that times three, that's 40 ringgit, per hour. So they are able to save up their money and bring that one whole lump sum, back home if and when they get found out.
Is that the general idea that they expect to be found out at some point in time and deported, but they think they would have made savings and those savings would justify all that they've been through?
Well, that's a common theme that I gathered, from the various individuals that I met. But at the same time, I wonder at what cost, or at the cost of being an illegal immigrant, at the cost of really, really, decrepit living conditions.
People make a lot of sacrifices for what they think is their future. Yeah, I mean, you'd also note that there's now a scam, and this was, of course, revealed on the pages of Utusan Malaysia and others, that Malaysians are going to Australia claiming asylum status, and because they know that the process of assessing that will give them enough time to make a nice and tidy sum of money they would never make back home.
Yeah, but you would think that you've got enough opportunities here in Malaysia.
But do they have? Whoa. I think this is the issue. We'll be back with more Sly and the Family Stone with Everyday People, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Sly and the Family Stone and Everyday People, Tan Chung Han, an everyday person, and myself, Sharad Kutin.
Not so everyday person.
I think I'm an everyday person. Dato Sri Dr. Saleh Said Kruat, the Communication and Multimedia Minister, is reported saying that this year's National Day celebration will include an enactment, or reenactment rather, of the Declaration of Independence. And this, of course, is 1957. So Merdeka 1957 refers exclusively to the Malayan Peninsula, not Sabah and Sarawak, because we became Malaysia only in 1963. So 1957, there was no Malaysia, there was just Malaya. The objective, apparently, of this reenactment is to remind Malaysians how difficult it was to achieve independence. BFM asked Edin Koo, founder and director of Pusaka, if he thinks this reenactment will convey the message successfully.
Well, I think a reenactment would be a great deal of fun, but really the point is understanding the message of Merdeka and independence. And this doesn't come about with a staged drama. This comes about with a constant dialogue and discussion and, accumulating or compiling or having a whole variety of views about the meaning of independence on a regular basis. Over the past 60 years, it should have been done. But it's still a good time to start. I mean, the enactment is all well and good, but if you really want us to have the spirit of Merdeka, it must be an everyday thing that is negotiated and talked about on a daily basis in all kinds of mediums.
We also asked Edin if there are other events in our history on that journey to independence that should be highlighted.
Well, let me just put it this way. History is in crisis in this country, okay? Because we do not emphasize the spirit of history itself. Recalling dates and events, according to their message or their enactments doesn't say very much about history. History should inform society, and for that to happen, there must be a daily engagement with it. What we have now is a history that some people say is constructed. I don't argue with that. I think in many realms it is constructed. And I would like to see a history that people are engaged with on a daily basis. I think people are crying for it. They're actually asking for it. But we don't have the platforms and avenues for it. And an enactment of the Declaration of Merdeka, nice as it is not going to help do that.
That was Edin Khoo, founder and director of Pusaka, because Pusaka does incredibly important work in preserving Malay heritage and culture and dance of the Mat Yongs and the Wayang Kulit and such. But okay, what do you make of his position that, you know, these one-offs really don't do it?
Yeah, look, it's important, don't get me wrong, it's very, very important, but it's going to be a tough sell though. I mean, let's face it, because, you know, especially for those who were born, you know, over the last few decades and not 60 years ago, the idea of freeing yourself from colonial powers, you know, how relevant is it today?
Okay, so there's a kind of effective divide. I mean, you work with young people.
Right.
Do you ever talk to them about these events? Do you think do they have
really.
This kind of glazed over look that comes over their eyes?
Because it's something that's so distant. Like, if you're going to convey the idea of, you know, having these overlords that, you know, dictate, you know, your life's course, you know, it comes in very different forms in the contemporary context versus what happened in 1957, right? So it's a whole different ballgame right now. So trying to make that relevant, you know, to the
But is it relevant to you? I mean, you're in your mid-30s,
yeah,
going on to 40, and I, you know, and so, you know, is it relevant to you?
Well, it's important. Relevant? I don't know. Important, yes.
What's the distinction that you make between relevance and importance?
Well, see, again, because obviously a lot of the Malaysian identity stems from the fact that we are an independent nation, and how much gains that we have seen since 1957 until now. Now, we have certainly come out to hold our own, although in a relatively smaller part of the global hierarchy, right? But does the Merdeka story, or, you know, what happened at Stadium Merdeka on August 31st, 1957, resonate with me every single day? Does it impact my life every single day? Not really. I mean, let's be honest here, though. Like, you know, how much?
Okay, let me put this to you. Right, we have a current discussion because you know, that was precipitated by the Prime Minister saying that Indian Muslims could get Bumiputra status. Now, the idea of Bumiputraism, right? Or the idea
that's quite the segue there, but okay.
No, it's not, because where was it? In what point of our history did citizens get divided between Bumiputras and non-Bumiputras? It was a specific moment. It was part of a political contract. Mm. It was agreed upon. All these things, right, you might argue about, but it did come from a certain history. So when you talk about today's an assertion of identity, right, or the desire that especially young people want for a non-racial Malaysia, meaning we don't want everything channeled through a racial lens, especially political matters and privileges and access to resources, you have to go back to those times, because that's what the politicians refer to constantly.
Sure. Now, if you have those kind of developments, then sure, but then are we in Malaysia, are we at risk of, like, say, being colonized again?
Well, the young people in Sabah and Sarawak today are being told constantly there was something called the Malaysia Agreement 1963, right? And they're reminded constantly that what they consider their disadvantaged position in the Federation is related to that moment. So that, for them, makes history very, very relevant.
Oh, yeah. Well, again, I guess trying to bring it back to the Peninsular context as well. I mean, I think I dare say that we are relatively ignorant about what happens over there in Sabah, Sarawak. No, but you're right. Having these kind of discussions.
Speak for yourself.
Broadly speaking, having these kind of discussions, yeah, I know it's a great talking point, but again, I still pose the question, is it as impactful on our day to day lives? I think that's a big question mark right there.
Coming up, Feist and a Gatekeeper, BFM 89.9. Good morning. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Tan Chung Han. And the morning run continues. It's coming up to 7 minutes past seven. It is the 21st of July. Very quickly, on Wednesday, or maybe not so quickly, the Communications and Multimedia Minister, Dato' Sri Dr. Saleh Syed Khoa, announced that RTM, Radio TV Malaysia, will cease broadcasting the global hit Despacito, which broke records in the midpoint of the week as one of the most downloaded songs, or stream songs, in history. And that, of course, has created a lot of discussions around whether government government has the right to be a moral guardian, the question of censorship and the state in this country. Now, we spoke to Kudzia Kaha, former chief operations officer at the Star Radio Group, and asked her what goes into these decisions to whether to allow or ban particular songs.
Okay, so historically in Malaysia, when all the private radio stations even were under the Ministry of Information back in the 70s, 80s, well, private radio stations came only back in the 90s, we had to follow something called a banned song list. Now, once a week, a bunch of people in RTM would sit down and listen to all new songs that were released by the record label. They would evaluate the lyrics and sound effects that go into the song as well. And then they would decide which one would be fit for airplay and which one would not be fit for airplay. Sometime when in the late 90s, like 97, 98, when more and more private radio stations were coming out, and I was with Astro at that time, they decided to not follow the banned song list anymore because we had ways to eliminate certain words or, you know, like beat them out, for example, from songs that were considered too suggestive. So then it was agreed that all the private radio stations, which at that time were under the purview of MCMT, to do their own evaluation of the song. Each radio station would ideally have a committee of 2 to 3 people who would listen to new songs, new releases, and deem them whether they would be fit for airplay or not.
Now, we also asked Kudzia what kind of responsibilities she thinks radio stations have to their listeners.
It's kind of a catch-22 situation at the moment because new music discovery is now more often than not on radio. You know, so new music discovery is more often on YouTube. That's still the number one place for new music discovery. And then, of course, there's streaming services like Spotify and Tidal, etc. Now, for radio stations to compete with that, it's kind of tough because if you want to wait for the record labels to release a safer version for radio airplay, it can sometimes take a while.
We also asked if she thinks that most radio stations lean towards a more conservative or generous interpretation of the code.
Well, it is, of course, the spirit of the guidelines for broadcasters is that you are given the responsibility to evaluate yourself. But if you ignore those responsibilities, then, of course, you're answerable. You know, if there's any investigation or letters that are sent over to you to say, please explain why you played this song or your DJs talked about this thing, etc. So it is entirely up to the radio station. They have the final say whether they want to air a song or not. There are still certain things, of course, that are not permitted according to the content code, which are songs that promote or incite hatred, racism, riots, and unrest, or songs that, you know, are very disrespectful or offensive to any certain race or religion.
And finally, back to the question of Despacito, we asked Kudzia if she thinks it has potential to cause harm.
All right, so the song is largely in Spanish. 90% of the, if you listen to the song in its original form, it's all in Spanish. Then, of course, there's a version with Justin Bieber as well. And if you look at the translated lyrics, they do sound very, very suggestive. But then so are a lot of other songs as well that have been aired on radio before, even here in Malaysia. Again, it's entirely up to the broadcaster whether they want to air it. Now, there are some who believe that we'll air it until somebody complains about it, then we'll take it off air. There are those who will say, no, we don't air it at all. But again, it comes to that point where if you don't air an extremely popular song, you know, especially younger listeners, they're just going to go to another streaming service or another radio station that will play the song.
That was Kudzia Kaha, former COO of Star Radio Group, weighing in on this very hot, controversial topic. And the song is apparently hot. And that raised the ire of some groups and who have managed to persuade the government of the day to censor the song, at least from the RTM platforms. But I think private radio stations don't play the, are still being asked to make their own decision on it.
That's right. And that is an important distinction to make because again, this ban applies only to government-run radio and TV outlets, like you pointed out. And I think Kutsi also hit the nail on the head there, because ultimately the intent of these guidelines by the MCMC is for these private entities to decide on their own. Now, I recall from my previous gigs at other government-controlled, not government-run, but government-controlled media outlets, and in the...
all government-controlled.
In the sessions that we had with the MCMC, essentially the spirit is this, that they will react upon public complaints. And this is exactly what happened in this case.
But the question is whether...
So this is in reaction to public complaints. So I dare say, again, using this very broad brush, that, you know, we, Gerard, you and I, we are operating in perhaps the more liberal segment of the Malaysian society. But broadly speaking, though, Malaysia is still a relatively conservative society.
But, you know, if you don't want to listen to a song, you just switch off the television.
And guess
what? Why should you have the right and power to disrupt my pleasures? And, you know, it comes back to this. We live in a country where people are infantilized. We are not treated as individuals and as adults. Adults should have the right to make choices for themselves. But the conservative minority or majority that you say exists out there, that have so much sway and influence, seem to think that they can make decisions for other people. And that is a problem. And they have persuaded, and these are politicians, we think of the women's wing of Amanah, they, if they come to power, will want also to control our private choices.
I agree with you. Okay, now,
should the state have right? Is the state the most competent authority to be our moral guardians? Look, is that what you're saying?
No, hold on. So, okay, I agree with you, okay, first and foremost. But in my discussions with those who are in regulatory or those in positions of authority, essentially they have said, again, I'm not trying to speak on behalf of those of people in authority, but in my discussions with them, they say that is that has been their message as well. When they get these complaints, they say, you know, hey, maybe just change the channel, right? But they are also in a position where to be seen to be upholding the moral values of the majority, right? So if they are, be it electorate or the public,
values of the majority cannot impinge on the rights of the minority. If that is not a democracy, that's majoritarian rule. That would be against the basic fundamental rights to freedom of expression, freedom to enjoy your own, make your own choices. What happens to a country that doesn't respect citizens as adults to make their own choices?
Sure. And that is a message that needs to be sent out to the Malaysian population at large. But again, whether you like it or not, at least from my very skewed experiences, you know, it tends to be an exclusive nature. It's either or. It's my values or yours. And we see that theme being played out so often. And very often, you know, because the government has to step in reaction to the public complaints, which is where it originated from, you know, often they kind of get a bad rap of sorts. Okay, again, I'm not saying I'm defending the government, but I'm trying to set the context here for why we have these kind of bans, so to speak. But again, as it stands, it's only for state-run radio and TV. Private radio stations, do your thing.
Okay, you get the last word this time. We'll be back with more BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.